Blog Talk Radio.
Assalamu alaikum and welcome to A Time for Justice. My name is Sister Pamela Muhammad, and this is a presentation of the Elevated Places Network entitled A Time for Justice. This show discusses legal and current events in a roundtable discussion with legal minds. Tonight, we're going to talk about Black people and immigration laws. And this is going to be a very interesting topic because on our shows, we like to discuss the country's centuries-long failure to apply, uphold, and enforce the laws and the overall failure of the legal system to give justice. Negative impacts these failures have had on Black people and their Black families. Ultimately, we want fair dealing. We want justice under the law. But all too often, this is not the action that we see. Tonight, our guests will not make those excuses for the racist conduct that we often see, which are really just distractions from the truth and the path to justice and equal protection. So let's talk about just, fair, and equitable solutions, which are really in the best interest of the people. Let's remove the distractions. As I said, tonight's topic is Black people and immigration law. And I think it's very interesting because today is the birthday of our brother Marcus Mosiah Garvey, who, as we know, Brother Marcus Garvey was a Jamaican-born great man in our history. He came here to this country, and actually this was back in, I think, the 1920s, but he started an organization for the upliftment of Black people called the Universal Improvement, I believe it was. And so it's very, very interesting to me that today is his birthday, and we would like to talk about our very important topic of Blacks and immigration. Now, it's very interesting, like I said, because we in the nation, I am Pamela Muhammad, and I'm an attorney. I'm also a member of the Nation of Islam. And one of the articles I think we use to frame this topic is how we, the Nation of Islam, building bridges across the global Black diaspora. And in this article, one of our brothers talked about, in quoting the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, that our unity is more powerful than an atomic bomb. Actually, and this was an article where a brother by the name of Earl X was quoted, because they were doing a workshop with many of the leaders. He spoke about Marcus Garvey building an American abroad. He talked about Thomas Sankara, Ahmed Sekou Touré of Ghana, Kwame Nkrumah, Jerry Rollins, Muammar Gaddafi, Frantz Fanon, the psychiatrist and author of The Wretched of the Earth, who was from the Caribbean. And he went on to say that all these brothers stress unity amongst ourselves to establish independence and self-determination. So we're going to get that as our background because, see, this is why it's important for us to talk about blacks and immigration as we talk about what is going on in the diaspora. We also have to look at the fact that as the NOI Research Group recently published in the Final Call an article entitled Depopulation Has Been the United States Policy for Centuries. And in that article, I just wanted to quote, they talk about when Columbus arrived in 1492, how historians estimated there were about 145 million people living in the Western Hemisphere. By 1691, the population of indigenous people had declined by 95% to just 15 million. And by 1930, whites had managed to isolate the red man on reservations and reduce his population to a mere 2 million. So again, looking at this depopulation agenda, that's another backdrop we have to look at when we look at immigration law and how it is related to blacks today. So I wanted to, without further ado, to talk about my special guest. We have some wonderful, wonderful guests tonight. We have two attorneys, and they practice in the area of immigration law. The first person I would like to introduce is our sister, Tiffany Muhammad. Sister Tiffany Muhammad is a graduate of Texas Southern University as an undergrad. I know Sister Tiffany also received a master's degree. Sister Tiffany also attended Texas Southern University, that's Thurgood Marshall School of Law, where she graduated with her law degree. And she is a practicing attorney. As I said, she does a lot of immigration law. She's actually originally from, I believe, Phoenix, Arizona, and she is a wife and a mother. And I would like to open up the microphone for Sister Tiffany Muhammad and welcome her. Let me see. Sister Tiffany.
Yes, ma'am. Assalamu alaikum, Attorney Pamela.
Way alaikum salam, Sister Tiffany. It's such a pleasure to hear your voice, and thank you for being a guest on our show tonight. The next attorney I would like to introduce is a brother by the name of Joseph Mockendale. Brother Joseph, also known as Brother Yusuf Mockendale, is currently the student representative of the Honorable Minister Aspire-Con to Haiti. And he is the general coordinator of the Haiti-based Respect for Life Foundation. Brother Joseph, he speaks four languages, including but not limited to Haitian Creole, French, and Spanish. Brother Joseph has done so much traveling as the Creole interpreter during one of the minister's visits to Haiti in December of 2011. Brother Joseph is a attorney, a goodwill representative, and an ambassador, engaging in many policy making and conflict resolution endeavors. By way of his background, Brother Joseph is the immediate past president of the Haitian American Lawyers Association of New Jersey. Brother Joseph Mockendale, and he's also known as Brother Mayor Mockendale, and he'll have to tell us about that particular political, I think, endeavor he was involved with. But Brother Mockendale, he holds a Bachelor of Arts in Psychology with a concentration on pre-medical science from Columbia University. Brother Joseph also attended Georgetown. He later attended Georgetown University Law, and he also graduated his Juris Doctorate from Vermont Law School. Brother Joseph he served as many different areas. He actually was a judicial law clerk to the Honorable Wendell Daniels in New Jersey, Ocean County. He practices in New Jersey, and he focuses primarily on immigration, criminal law, personal injury, business, and family law. Brother Joseph, I'm going to bring him on because, as I say, this brother is really a very dynamite, very talented, and I'm sure he's going to really enlighten us on these different subjects. So, Brother Joseph, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, dear sister. Thank you so much for having invited me and our sister on the line to share a few thoughts with your audience. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming, and I'm just so excited because immigration law is something that we as, we as black people, a lot of times we don't know because we, the descendants of slaves that were raised here in America, we, a lot of times, we just look at things that pertain to us. And I think, as I read earlier, the unity part is one of the things we want to get across to our people, as well as the fact that because we are united and we are the same people, the same targeting and depopulation agenda and the racism that black immigrants face is something that, you know, does affect us, and not just affecting the people who migrated, but also we as black Americans, as well as the gifts that we have received from such rich culture and leadership that many of our immigrant brothers and sisters brought to the country. So I wanted to just open it up by talking, what is immigration law? And four ideals, unify families, bring foreign nationals who have skills to the U.S. economy, protect refugees and people at risk, like increasing diversity. So there's some of the background. Brother Joseph, can you give us some, what is the foundational basis of immigration law in this country? Can you give us a little bit of that?
Certainly. Thank you so much for this question. Immigration law of this country has been founded pretty much on the Naturalization Act of 1790. It was an act that was first established in order to provide a process for how to become a naturalized citizen of the United States. As you know, around that time, there was a number of black people who were already in the United States, and they did not have the benefit of using that immigration law or the Naturalization Act of 1790. And it was until the inception of the 14th Amendment, of course, the 13th Amendment abolished slavery, and the 14th Amendment did recognize those individuals who were already in the United States who did not even file a petition to become a U.S. Citizen. They were granted citizen by virtue of their presence and their birth on the land. So the immigration laws pretty much is centered upon the process of becoming a naturalized citizen, and then subsequently there was the Alien Act of 1798. Part of the Alien Act, and also it's called Sedition Law, is that the president was authorized to expel any alien he deemed dangerous. They used the term alien from the very beginning. Now they're trying to stay away from that term. But that act of in 1798 was created to expel any alien who are deemed dangerous. And this law was very unpopular and expired after 2 years. However, an Alien Enemies Act still exists to permit the removal of alien enemies during hostilities. And it's important to give a quick background of what was going on around that time in 1798. We had the Haitian Revolution in 1791 that started, you know, with Bookman. And this caused a lot of whites from Haiti to flee Haiti and to migrate to the United States. And of course, those whites who had slaves, who had enslaved Africans from Haiti, they sought to bring their enslaved Africans from Haiti with them. And those enslaved Africans were considered basically dangerous because they were concerned that those enslaved Africans from Haiti would contaminate the minds of those blacks in America to want to rise up against the slavery structure, the slavocracy, as they call it. In America. So this is just pretty much a background. I don't want to, you know, take too long to answer the question. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Thank you for that. And you know what? That was great. And I also, in the depopulation article written by the NOI Research Group, of course, they went on to talk about how the transatlantic slave trade was also a part of the depopulation, where slave in the transatlantic slave trade, Europeans devastated the continent and reduced Africa's population by untold millions, a cataclysmic holocaust that opened up the interior for centuries of exploitation. And then they say no one on earth but the white man can claim to have committed two separate holocausts and two separate hemispheres simultaneously. So what I'm saying is that we as black people were brought here, you know, not by virtue of any kind of immigration, volunteer. We were brought here as kidnapped victims, as we know, in the transatlantic slave trade. And what the NOI Research Group is saying, it also caused interior damage for centuries with the exploitation of the continent of Africa, the Caribbeans, and all of this damage that we see. So bringing this to the modern times, are we still seeing this depopulation policy where we see the targeting and the arrest and the deportation of black immigrants? Are they being discriminated against in what you all see as some of the day-to-day practices?
Certainly. Is this directed to me?
Yes, sir. Anybody wants to answer?
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
I'll answer next.
Yeah.
Go ahead, brother.
Go ahead, sister.
Okay.
Go ahead,
sister. Yes. Okay, thank you, counsel. Attorney Pamela, to your first question, thank you again, Attorney Joseph. He did a remarkable job giving the historical framework and some historical bases when he mentioned the Haitian Revolutionary Act. I know Brother will have more details on that later. That is extremely important in regards to looking at immigration. But I wanted to also, just for a note of historical significance, or just I looked up the early Webster definition of an American, just checking out the definition, and it stated a citizen of the United States or of early British colonies, one not belonging to one of the aboriginal races. So, again, one not belonging to one of the aboriginal races. So to me,
wow,
that kind of sums up the intentions, and you can kind of get the gist of the root of white supremacy being the basis of U.S. immigration laws. He mentioned the 1790 in the pathway. Again, totally always keep in mind, we know best that it was for white Europeans, you know, these initial immigration laws. So I think Brother Joseph already kind of got into that. So I don't know if you wanted to comment on that follow-up question, Attorney.
Yeah, you can go ahead because I know.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead, Brother Joseph. Well, what I was going to say, I know when we talk about deportation, we're talking about this temporary immigrant status. We're talking about green cards. We're talking about black people needing to make a pathway to belong in the United States. You know, what type of obstacles are they facing? And could you all kind of tell us some of what you're seeing in the courts? Is there systemic racism? As Sister Tiffany said, this country doesn't even want black people as Americans, so don't consider us that. So what are you all seeing in some of your day-to-day practices?
Well, one thing.
Yeah, go ahead, Brother Joseph.
Yeah, for one thing, the attitude, the anti-black attitude that the U.S. government and its institutions have toward black people have tremendously affected the issue of deportation. Just very simply, if with racial profiling, you know, just the sheer fact that police officers have a tendency to profile someone based on their race or ethnicity, that would ultimately affect amongst the immigrants, mostly the black populations, from that practice alone. And as a result of which, this will cause those who have been targeted to be placed into the criminal justice system. And if the person has an irregular status or is undocumented, or is documented but cannot afford to have a number of arrests or certain type of charges, these individuals will ultimately be placed in removal proceedings and be subject to deportation. And so that alone, that anti-black policy of the United States of America through the executive branch is certainly affecting black immigrants unproportionally.
Yes.
Yes, sir. I'd like to add just media. Well, I know in the media, rather, last year there were some coverage because it's almost invisible. Brother Joseph probably can bear me witness in regards to the brutal torture and abuse and detention camps that hold immigrants, especially African, Caribbean immigrants. Of course, the Brown brothers and sisters as well, but it's just a double jeopardy, like a double impact on our people. For number one, you know, they come a longer route. Obviously, for those who come, they come from all over. I mean, I've met, it wasn't my client, but when I was working with a volunteer organization, I met a young lady. She was from the Congo. And I'm just thinking that this is incredible, you know, such a far away. And I didn't know too much about the Congo, but it definitely, after meeting her, and she was refugee, Brother Joseph, she just described the harsh reality. And that's when we get more, Sister Pam, into the political, the policy, and what makes one have to travel the distance, such dangerous terrain, to come
right,
this far,
okay.
And to only come to North America, where, you know, we think it's all, you know, well, they have ambitions and desires for better, period. But when you look at the conditions that they live under, we can get into that a little later. But in regards to her, the treatment that she had experienced once she made touchdown in the U.S. and just how unfair tensions, I don't know if anyone was able to see in the media where they had a, Brother Joseph, help me. It was they were doing a, not a fast, but they were due to the conditions in the detention because they were they were literally, people were going, they had medical issues that were not being addressed. It was horrible. No food, and of course, everyone, I think 2019 got a picture of the children, especially our Central American brothers and sisters, made media where they showed the children being, you know, left with no parents, you know, children taking care of children in these like literal like zoo cages. So, again, that's just more on the lines of the abuse and the different tortures once they get here and being detained in such inhumane circumstances. It's just ridiculous. It's totally inhumane.
And then I would add to this, even the president of Ghana had to caution a lot of those Africans, please do not buy into the imageries that the media has been promoting in Africa to entice those, in Ghana and other African countries to wanting to take this this very dangerous path of migrating to Europe and other places like America, because mm-hmm. as Sister just indicated, the way that they've been projecting, those countries like, you know, Europe and America, they do it in such a way to, you know, just show them the most positive side. It's almost like it's a branding process, so that will cause them to really do everything they can to make it to that promised land. In fact, there was a story about a sister from Africa, the country is escaping me for a moment, but she was coming with her family with seven children from Africa, and then she finally made it to Ecuador. From Ecuador she made it to Mexico, and there she was intercepted and detained and held in prison. When they were finally released, there was no place for them to stay, and they had to sleep on the streets, as many black migrants are forced to do. And she was talking about this difficulty that she was going through, and with tears streaming down her face, she indicated to the interviewer that, but at least I can't wait to come to America, where I will be able to find safety and security and refuge. And the question is, has she heard of, you know, all those brothers and sisters who have been killed, you know, like, for instance, Botham Jeans from St. Lucia, whose family is from St.
Right.
Lucia, was killed while he was just sitting in his own apartment eating ice cream and watching television. And we have over 229 black men and women who have been killed since our brother in Minnesota was killed. So it's really interesting that people are not being fed these type of news, and so they're coming with that notion that this is a place of refuge. And once they get there, they have a rude awakening. And so this is really a truism that the media has a lot to do with enticing black immigrants to come to the United States as well.
Wow, right. Yeah, because I was reading some statistics in this Baji, I think you told me about, Brother Joseph, where – you know, they say there's no evidence that black immigrants commit more crimes, greater rate of crimes than any other people, but yet and still they're deported and put into removal proceedings at much greater rates. So this is where we're seeing the same type of surveillance that is being dealt upon in our community. Is that true? Is that what you all are seeing? in some of these courts. Yeah. Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to go ahead.
I'm glad you mentioned Badgie because for those who don't know of your listening audience, Badgie is the Black Alliance for Just Immigration. It is a racial justice and migrant rights organization that engages in education advocacy, to a great extent, cross-cultural alliance building. And this organization, I was able to interact with them back in 2017, and our student minister there, Brother Yu, whose new name is escaping me now. Please forgive me, Brother Yu.
Waliala.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. So he was very instrumental in welcoming Badgie in San Diego, California, and we had a meeting there, and he hosted us, and he participated in that meeting, and we had a 3 days conference, and during those 3 days conference, we went to visit some of the Black immigrants at the San Diego Detention Center there, where we had firsthand communications with some of those migrants, and to have pretty much a sense of what they've gone through in order to get to that point and how they were being treated while they were in prison. And so I just wanted to add that, as you mentioned the name Badgie, and give just a little bit of background, to the name.
Yes, sir. Excellent. Because I think one of the things, why I come here, to get a lot of our listeners to understand the depth of immigration law, and why we fight so hard for our people who are in these proceedings and trying to make a path to citizenship. Brother Joseph, you mentioned how sometimes these people are victimized by policies, foreign policies, that create a need for them to come for a better life. I know there was an article in the Final Call regarding a Cameroon situation from 2016. And in that particular article, it's called Immigration Service Cancels African Deportations After Torture Reports. And pretty much this article was saying how a plane carrying Cameroonians, Angolan, Congolese asylum seekers, they were leaving this Alexandria, Louisiana port because that's one of the places they depart from. And the actual plane was stopped. And the people, I think ICE canceled the planned deportation to allow victims the opportunity to be interviewed because there were, there were allegations of actual, torture to the people mm-hmm. who were in these detention centers. But the article talks about how the civil war in Cameroon had necessitated the people being here and that perhaps the United States had helped create that mess. So this is, something that people don't understand. I think in this article they talk about how the people, the detention detainees in this Alexandria detention center were being tortured. They were being threatened to be thrown into COVID wards and exposed to all kinds of insanitary conditions. But again, like you told me, Brother Joseph, a lot of these people are victims of unjust policies that occur in their countries so are our people, when they come, are they given the same fair treatment that some of these other refugees are given when they come to the country, to the United States, seeking protection and status?
That's a very good point you raised, sister, and that was balanced what we mentioned before as far as the reasons why we have an influx of migrants. It's not just because of what they see on TV and, you know, the attraction, the enticement that those shows and movies have created, but also there are some genuine reasons why they would want to flee their land. It may not be applicable necessarily to Ghana, which will explain why the president of Ghana would make such a plea to its citizens. But generally, an individual who would take that leap of faith and leaving their place of origin, the place where they were born, to migrate all the way, you know, to a foreign land, it is due oftentimes to serious fear of persecution and torture, which essentially falls within the definition of a refugee, which is basically is an individual seeking refuge or asylum, especially an individual who has left his or her native country and is unwilling or unable to return to that country because of persecution or fear of persecution. And that persecution can be based on reason of race, religion, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion, or imputed political opinion. These are social conditions that may exist in a particular country. The question is, how did those social conditions, or political conditions, or economic—I won't say economic strike that—but political and social conditions are created. And the interesting thing is, those social and political conditions can also affect the economic condition where poverty is unbearable. But of course, immigration does not recognize in economic ground. They only recognize political opinion, being part of a social group that have been targeted, a religious group or race that have been targeted because of that. Again, the question that must be addressed is what would create those conditions for persecution, and are these necessarily germane from the people, or is there any external forces that are acting upon those nations creating instability? And if those forces do exist, then shouldn't those forces bear the brunt of responsibility for having created the problem in the first place, and then seeing the influx of people coming from their land, their place of origin, coming to those superpowers who are creating those problems in the first place. And I think that's what we see in a lot of countries like Haiti, right, and some countries in Africa, where the United States of America or France or other European countries, they go in and meddling with the political affairs of those countries and creating factions and whatnot and civil wars because they need to get access to certain resources there. And then the people are now escaping because they have no place to stay anymore. They are seeking refuge in the United States, and then here they come, and the laws is saying, oh, you can't come in because of X, Y, and Z reasons. This is what I wanted to share, and I'm one of them myself. I'm from Haiti. I didn't choose to come to Haiti because I just wanted to move out of my beautiful land called Haiti.
Yes, sir.
At the time that I was in Haiti, I was fine. We were happy to be where we were, but there was political instabilities that were exacerbated by the United States meddling in our political affairs with the complicity of our own people who were corrupt and were corruptible. And that essentially caused us to having to flee the country because of fear of persecution and insecurity there.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And, you know, that is very important, especially as we, you know, our thoughts and our prayers are with the people of Haiti, because as we know, there was a 7.2 magnitude quake that the news is reporting killed more than 1,200 people and injured 5,700 in the Caribbean country on Saturday. And this is something we're getting off of MSNBC, I believe, as well as the fact that their president was assassinated on July 7th. And Brother Joseph, I see an article that was in the Final Call July 13th, 2021, where it was seeking reasons behind the crisis in Haiti. And you're quoted in that article as saying Haiti has a lot of moving parts. Said Youssef Macandal, an attorney and Haiti representative for the Nation of Islam, we should do what is based on life stake, not political stake. And decisions should be made to find ways to avoid the bloodshed and avoid more violence. This is what you're quoted as saying. So could you just tell us about the mentality and how you think people are coping in Haiti, Brother Youssef?
Well, that quote is actually from the Honorable Mr. Louis Farrakhan, and I don't know how it came out to be my quote, but that was
okay.
The minister's words to me, and then I expressed it to the final call.
Okay.
And
yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yes.
Thank you for correcting that.
Yes, ma'am. So it is indeed a policy of dividing and conquer. In Haiti, and we were at a juncture where the political crisis was at its zenith back in before the assassination of President Jovenel, that I had to seek advice and guidance from the Honorable Mr. Louis Farrakhan in sifting through this crisis, because It was so murky that just taking a position one way or the other would put one in a very precarious position.
Okay.
And so that's how politics is run in Haiti. And so the Honorable Mr. Farrakhan guided me to make decisions that are based on life's stake, not on political stake. So when once we focus on what is in the best interest of the lives of the Haitian people, then things got clearer, where you don't have to worry about what politician will be accepting of that position or not, because the goal is not to favor a political party, but it is to favor life.
Yes, sir. Beautiful. And I think you go on to say here that unity as the path to peace in Haiti and avoiding the bloodshed and gang violence, that Mr. Macandal. So that is really beautiful. I commend you. And like I say, our prayers for the people of Haiti, because you do see, I saw something where one of the congresswomen, I believe the sister from Missouri, is now calling for increased, you know, welcoming of people from Haiti into the United States if that's that temporary, what is that called? Temporary
protective status.
Yeah, temporary. And I think there have been some changes to the temporary protective status. Isn't that right, Brother Joseph or Sister Tiffany? That may really help out. Is that what we're thinking? In terms of immigration law. And let me say this real quick. Please, this is a listener and caller-generated conversation. And while we have Brother Joseph on, as well as Sister Tiffany, if you have any questions or comments, please press the 1 button to get into the queue. If anyone has any questions they ask about this particular topic, please press the number 1, and we will definitely take your calls and questions and comments. Thank you. and so Brother Joseph or Sister Tiffany.
Yes, Sister Tiffany, hello. You want to address that, Sister Tiffany?
You can address the Haiti. I know the law has changed for TPS, and you know it's country specific. But in regards to Guatemala and the several other countries except Haiti, I'm aware that there had not been an extension. So my last update that they will be terminating October. So again, that's temporary protective status. Brother Joseph, you may want to inform me if there's been a recent update. And I would like to say in immigration law, it's very complex from the mere, of course, it's a federal, but it changes every day. Literally before I left the office, the Fifth Circuit, they got something new. And it's for post-conviction, Brother Joseph, if you check that out as far as notice. But, no, I'm talking every day. I don't know all the areas of law. I do not. But the few that I do know, you don't change every day. So I really appreciate the rigor that Brother Joseph, 20 years, I'm not sure how long he's been doing immigration law, but it makes sense, though. It's federal. You got these circuit courts, you know.
17 years.
17 years. Let me tell you, I don't think he sleeps. Because it's always something to read new. But go ahead, Brother Joseph, with the TPS and the Haitian. I'm not aware of the latest.
Yeah. Yeah. And let me just,
just to be quick, Sister touch upon it. There has been a change, as Sister just indicated. It keeps on changing. Because of the assassination of the president of Haiti and also the political instability there, the TPS was extended for Haitians, and they are allowed now to apply between August 3rd and February 3rd of 2023, and then they will have the temporary protective status for 18 months for those who came in the United States prior to July 29, 2021. So those who came after that date, they will not be, they will not have the benefit of the TPS. But I suspect, I'm just making a prediction here, because of the earthquake in Haiti, there might be another amendment to allow those who came right after the earthquake or who were there on the day of the earthquake. So because in 2010, they did the same thing for the earthquake on January 12, 2010. For those who came right after.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Well, and we have a question or a comment. Let me open up the mic. Sister Marguerite, assalamu alaikum.
Yes. Well, alaikum salam. Well, Sister Pamela, when I first heard you talk about the damage that was done to Africa, I remember telling my sons years ago when we, you know, as I raised them, can you imagine the devastation if these white folks had super tankers at the time? You know, it would have just wiped Africa clean out. And your comment really brought that back to mind in the reality of what was done. But you mentioned about this. Yes, ma'am. You talking about a subject that I have been studying kind of lately, you know, over the years, but more so lately, the Final Call had written an article about the CIA and the wars and the all the little devilish things that the CIA had done around the world. And it was from an article in Harper's Bazaar in the 80s. But I found out that, you know, the formation of the CIA was as the enforcement arm of the multinational corporations. It had nothing to do with, you know, being another government agency or something like that. It was formed by attorneys who represented these multinational corporations, and they bribed I can't remember which president it was, Hoover, to do it. And he, you know, he quickly regretted it, but it was too late. But the thing that when I look at what has happened to our brothers and sisters in Haiti, this is in their playbook. You know, this is what they do for these multinational corporations. And so when it occurred, I mean, this is what they do. So we're looking at them, and I also read a book called by Naomi Klein, K-L-E-I-N, called The Shock Doctrine, and it shows how what they do is through shock and through doing events like assassinating the president, like creating circumstances in people's countries where they're running away from their ancestral lands, you know, to seek asylum. So we already know who did.
That's right.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
That's right.
Right. And that goes back to the depopulation article by the NOI Research Department that talks about the cataclysmic Holocaust that opened up the interior for centuries of exploitation. And even our brother, who I quoted earlier in the Building Bridges Across the Global Black Diaspora, and, you know, this was that workshop they were doing to, you know, to talk with Brother Akbar and international representative, even that brother talked about the counterintelligence program of the United States government, and he talked about that in reference to saying how leadership, the rise of leadership in the black community, and just how it's always been used to prevent our unity. So I think you're absolutely right, sister. And, you know, thank you so much for that comment. Because that's one of the things, Brother Joseph, you and I, we promised we were going to talk about. And this is this myths and stereotypes that I think is a cloud over immigration and immigrants that sometimes keep us divided, black people divided from one another. And I think that's part of the you know, the divisiveness here in America. And so I want Sister Tiffany as well, you, Brother Joseph, you work with these people that are coming here seeking help. Why should black Americans, you know, why should we embrace our brothers and sisters? What are you all seeing when you're dealing with these families and working people and honest people that are really just trying to make better lives for themselves? So could you, you know, express some of that, please?
Yeah. You mentioned earlier, sister, you mentioned the name of Marcus Muzari Garvey.
Okay, yes, sir.
Marcus Muzari Garvey was from Jamaica. And there are a number of other folks who have been very instrumental in shaping the black liberation movement and the black struggle in America that are from, you know, other places from the Caribbean as well. I mean, one very obvious is the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, parents. You know, whose parents are from the Caribbean. Father is from Jamaica and mother is from St. Kitts.
Yes,
so he's a product of the Caribbean. We have Kwame Ture, also known as Toki Carmichael, who's from Trinidad, and Audre Lorde, whose both parents are from the Caribbean, and in a number of others, like James Weldon Johnson, the man who was the executive, the secretary of the NAACP, who wrote the song Lift Every Voice and Sing. His great-grandmother was from Haiti. W.E. Du Bois' family was from Haiti as well. So it's like, again, it's the dividing to conquer, to make people think, to make our people think that people from outside of black people outside of America are considered as the other, so they are othering us when we are supposed to be brothers, not others. So it's part of the, you know, the teaching of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, to create that nervous system within us as black people, not as Haitian, Jamaican, black Americans, but as black people, to understand that our struggle is universal. There's a common thread that runs through it because we have a common enemy with a common condition. And as a matter of fact, we see how those black immigrants who may think that they are better, but once they come to America, they are being treated just like those blacks in America, the black so-called Americans. And this is to that alone should tell both, like, look, you know, we are brothers. We're not others to each other.
Yes, sir. Sister Tiffany, what are you saying? Yes, ma'am.
I was going to say, he said it, but I had even thought about it when we were thinking about why should we not see ourselves different, and, you know, why should it be important for us black Americans to take our brethren, you know, from Caribbean or an African. But I looked up, and one name that came to mind was Sarah Mae Manning. And as brother said, that is they would say immigrant, but that is the beautiful sister who birthed the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. And as brother pointed out, she's from St. Kitts, and we know her husband was Jamaican, and I believe the minister's stepfather was from Bahamas. So, I mean, that just tells the whole story, you know, right there, why it's important that we find it necessary to find unity. And I was thinking about Supreme Wisdom question number 5 and why the devil, why do he call our people Africans? And, you know,
go ahead.
Teach. Yeah, that comes to mind because he don't want to, it's a trick. It's a trick because we are the same. And it's so easy to think that, or to think you're better than thou. I got the opportunity, or I'm here, you know, you all are taken from our resources. You got to check your thinking. Because who's, you know, that's not proper. That's not the teachings of Honorable Elijah Muhammad. So that's why I thank Allah for the teachings, because, you know, practicing in immigration, it's a unique area, and I don't think I would appreciate it as much if I didn't have the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the leadership of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. Because it just makes it so relevant and so clear, and I understand the significance. Study, I want to be, learn the law and help those and help others. But this is a unique opportunity, the way I see it. It's a unique opportunity to help those. And the sister who called, I think her name was Sister Marguerite, but she pointed out, or she had an interest in the harshness of the conditions in those countries, what would make people come here. And I just wanted to point out that one client that I told you, she wasn't my client, but I met her. She was from she was from the Congo. And I just looked up the DRC. Just keep in mind, now this is the natural resources that the DRC have, you know, has had. And again, that's back to Supreme Wisdom, talk about producing land, which is in Africa. But the DRC is the home to raw mineral ores worth estimated $24 trillion. So when you think about Teslas and phones, cell phones, all those, they're all dependent based on minerals from the Congo. And yes, I said Tesla. So $24 trillion, that's what's for the taking over there. And those people there's water shortages. 70% of the people that live in that population, they have no access to adequate food supplies. You have so many different guerrilla warfares because you have those that are, you know, it's a British run. Correct me if I'm wrong, Brother Joseph. Think those are the initial colonizers. That one's a little special, the Congo. But even till today, to this day, it is corruption over there. It's murderous. The people, I mean, talking to the young lady to learn that she loved her country, she said, it's beautiful. The people, you know, their spirits and soul, she would never want to leave, except she would die. It's so dangerous over there. And if you heard me say $24 trillion, you can understand the extent. So that's what will make one get on an airplane, travel all the way, I mean, traveling from the Congo to, you have to come through a certain way through the Ecuador, as brother pointed out before, because Ecuador, they have less restriction on their allowing you in with visa or whatnot. So they have to come, and it's so dangerous. Once they touch down to Ecuador, they have to go through something called the Darien, I think it's called the Darien Gap. It's just straight Congo. You may live, you may not, but you just have to think back to Sister Margaret's call where she says she studied or she hear about the travesty and what goes on in these countries in Africa. Although their natural resources are there, but in fact, that's what makes it so dangerous and unbearable, because the devil is there. And our people, you know, we are suffering. So that just kind of
Sister opened a can of gold, not a can of oil, a can of gold, when she made reference to you know, those natural resources. I am reminded that the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. The whole 196,940,000 square miles of land is ours, is the Lord's.
Yes, sir.
And so the question is, who are the Lords? We are the Lords, the land Lords. And I remember the Honorable Mr. Louis Farrakhan said one day, you know, in reference to, you know, our people being deported here and there, he said that there will be a time that there will be no such thing as borders. How are you going to have we have deportation when there's no borders? Who are you going to deport them to, you know, out of the earth? No, because the earth is the Lord's, is for us. So when this becomes a reality, you know, wherever we are at home on the planet Earth. So this is going to be the end of immigration law as we know it. They probably will be interstellar immigration law, but not national or terrestrial immigration law. And so there is another point that I wanted to make quickly, is that Haiti is rich, from my understanding, of what is called iridium. Iridium is one of the rarest metal on earth, and it goes for about $1,300 per ounce. It says that Haiti has so much iridium, which is after the Congo, there's a place in Africa was known to have iridium. Haiti has the purest and most abundant of iridium. And each and every one of those 12 million Haitians were given access to their own natural resources, including the iridium. Each and every one of those Haitians would be a multimillionaire. So, obviously, that's why, you know, they keep on repeating that Haitians are the poorest country in the whole Western Hemisphere. Wow. And how come we are the poorest, and yet the largest U.S. embassy in the Western Hemisphere is in Haiti?
Wow.
Brother Joseph, can you tell us a little bit about the background of why Haiti paid France $21 billion since
1825? Oh, yes. Well, I'm so happy you asked this question. When the Haitians, enslaved Africans, led by Dessalines, when they defeated Napoleon in 1803, Napoleon used to be a superpower in the world. You know, everybody was afraid of Napoleon, but we were the first to defeat Napoleon, and Napoleon had a lot of land in the Western Hemisphere, particularly what we call the United States of America. Part of the United States only had 13 colonies to the East Coast, but Napoleon had land that is equivalent to 14 states, which was a massive land that was greater than that of those 13 colonies. And because Napoleon was defeated by the great Haitian army, back then we were not Haitian yet, we were the African army, Napoleon had to liquidate all its assets, including that territory called Louisiana, for $15 million. I'm talking about 828,000 acres of land. $15 million at 3 cents per acre. And the question is, did Napoleon had the right to enter into that treaty with the United States of America to sell the land after they had lost the war with Haiti? So technically, Louisiana and all those other territories should rightfully be for Haiti, just the same way we acquired the land called Haiti due to war. So you mean to tell me that Haiti is for the Haitians because we fought and won the war against Napoleon, but yet we cannot have a right of ownership to the other rest of properties that Napoleon possessed? So that will be a question for great legal minds like Sister Tiffany and others to ponder upon. And so Napoleon had to liquidate that large piece of land for $15 million in 1803. Just think about that for a second. In 1803, they liquidated $15 million, that piece of land that allowed United States to double in size and cause United States to expand toward the west. That's how they acquired New Mexico and California and Nevada and all those other lands. And then a few years later, in about 27 years later or so, France, through threats and of extortion, to threats of bringing Haiti back into slavery, had cannons pointing toward Haiti, to saying that if we don't sign a treaty agreeing to pay France 150 million gold in bullion in gold, that they will bring us back into slavery. So in order for France to recognize our independence and sovereignty, in 1825, one of our weak leaders had to sign this treaty, and that amount of money we paid, it took us about 122 years to pay that fake reparation to independence debt to France. And that's why France is so well developed, because every year 85% of our budget will be going to France to prop up France. Meanwhile, Haiti was impoverishing every year from 1825 all the way to now. And meanwhile, France was having the Tour Eiffel and all those beautiful construction, because it was financed by Haitian blood. So that money is worth $22 billion now, and we still want that money from France.
Wow.
That's right.
That is fascinating. So, yes, sir, thank you for that history, because everybody always wants to know the history that has been hidden from us, and so we thank you for sharing that. And I wanted to say, as we're wrapping up, because we're down to 20 minutes, I know immigration law. I don't know how to practice immigration law. That's not my area, but I want to tell the listeners that this is a very complicated area of law. As Sister Tiffany said, the law, it looks like it changes every day to me. And these lawyers are spending countless hours in books and looking at law, and it changes every day. So we do want to give them, I want to give both of you all a congratulations for choosing this area. And just like other areas of law And just like other areas, sometimes we've had lawyers come on and they'll give our people advice like, you have a right to remain quiet, or, this is what you need to do to make sure your case is handled properly so you can get to a lawyer. Is there something that you think our listeners need to know that they can tell someone who needs a immigration lawyer, before they get to the lawyer? What do they need to make sure they – Is there anything or some tidbit of law y'all want to offer to the listeners?
No, number one, get a black lawyer.
Okay.
No, truthfully, real quick, Sister Pam, I just wanted to make a correction. That's Supreme Wisdom question number 6.
why did the devil call our people African? For anybody who wants to double check that. Yeah. But, no, I'm serious, Sister Pam, especially when you have what we call, Brother Joseph, when you have those special cases, meaning it's not a straight case because you had a lot going on. And I mean, you know, maybe you had a DUI or you had some other elements to your situation with your asylum claim. So I'm just saying you definitely want to get a lawyer because, again, with all the flexibility in the ongoing changes, you have to have creative lawyering going on because it takes a lot to be able to be able to make it happen. Because I just know too many, just for an example, I'm just going to say this, but it's been experienced, a couple of Jamaican clients quick to run to Beverly Hills. They're going to get the best, right? Give them 30, you know, 20, 25, $30,000. And guess
what?
Yeah. They all come back to my firm. They do because it doesn't get handled because I worked a really, really experienced, seasoned, amazing Jamaican attorney. But anyhow, I'm just saying and I'm looking at the issues missed, you know, I'm looking at all that wasn't happened. And a lot of it has to do not just with because I'm black, but the culture. Like I'm sure Brother Joseph knows certain things that that your Haitian or Jamaican or whatever client may happen and experience, but it's a culture gap if you don't catch it or you're not able to explain it because, you know, the declaration is everything. So I just think that's first and foremost, Sister Pam.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And those are family issues a lot of times as well, right? So we'll look at family issues as black people, and we can understand, oh, this is what was really going on culturally. So I think that's an excellent point, Sister Tiffany. And Brother Joseph, did you have something you wanted to share as well regarding, you know, what they need to know, what our people need to know when they, you know, before they get to you, or and I want you both to tell the audience how to get to you. Can you give us your information, how people listening may be able to contact you all for legal services?
Yes. Well, it's important for our people to know that there are several ways to get access to for certain immigration benefits, you know, the common asylum and family petition, but also if someone has been a victim of a crime, or somebody has been engaged or have been a victim of domestic violence, that person has the right, no matter whether the person is legal, especially for those who are not legal, that individual can reach out to an immigration attorney and try to apply for immigration benefits under what is called the U visa. And so to be able to demonstrate that the person has been a victim of domestic violence or victim of simple assault or a certain type of crimes, robbery, things to that effect, they can seek immigration benefits on that basis as well. So the way I can be reached is by phone. I can be reached by 732-240-0030. That's my phone number, and that's about it.
Yes, sir. Beautiful. Thank you for that. And Sister Tiffany, did you want to tell us how you could be reached as well?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Thank you, Sister Pamela. So my telephone, well, first I'm at 3255 Wilshire Boulevard, Los Angeles. Of course, immigration is federal. I do travel, well, COVID, so I'm really not traveling. But anyhow,
right.
We are able to help you. A lot of telephonic hearings are there. But I'm here in Los Angeles-based, but my telephone number, area code 213-248-2870, email tbmlawgroup@gmail.com.
And my email address is champagnelaws with an S, .org. Champagnelaws at gmail.org. CHAMPAGNELAWS at gmail.com. And my website is www.champagnelaw.usa.org. Again, champagnelaw.usa.org. I'm in New Jersey. And I do travel like Sister Stephanie, but I'm cautious.
Yeah. And that's the beautiful thing. I think that's so important. If you call the attorneys, they can give you specifics on it. But my understanding is that with immigration law, it's a lot more global. It's not just always like if you're in that state or you're in that, you know, particular. But you have to speak with them specifically. But I think that's one of the beautiful things. So I kind of had two other things I wanted to cover as we're closing out. I know with, you know, we know usually educational purposes is sometimes what brings people here. There's also an area where sometimes people come from other countries to do business in the United States and perhaps even provide jobs and businesses. And, it, you know, is that something that we see more Black people able to get into? The providing the businesses and setting up companies. I think, you know, as we're building our global world here, that's definitely something that I would like to see. Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
Definitely. And I'll say that's one of the benefits. I'm sorry, were you finished, Sister Pam?
I am finished, yes, ma'am.
Okay. Yeah, I was just going to make a comment that is one of another benefit with having our Black immigrants because of their what traditionally that they have what they accomplish. The United States, it's said they need immigrants to stay competitive, drive economic growth. I think I don't know the count for Caribbean, but I know Nigerian immigrants, they tend to have more education than the average American. So the jobs like Caribbean for sure, but those who don't go to the universities to get degrees, but they do open businesses and create job opportunity. And immigrants, they're innovative, again, job creators, consumers. So those are just some of the gains for this North America, U.S. economy that immigrants bring. And I know a lot of times one of the things I was really surprised to learn initially was that you always hear that the burden on the system, the drag, they're taking the jobs.
Right.
They're feeding off
the stereotypes again.
The stereotypes. But what I'm seeing, I'm seeing that, you know, like with the TPS, one thing that allows when you get the authorization to stay with whatever TPS green before your green card, if you don't have that green card, but you have a work authorization, meaning you're working and participating in this economy, guess what you're doing? You're paying taxes. And a lot of immigrants and a lot of undocumented, they come here and they work for 30 years, right? They have no status for those who were able to get employment that required it, and they will never get Social Security, okay? So basically they're financing our Social Security. So people don't like to look at the exchange, and I thought that was pretty interesting because I've always been just, you know, under the illusion that they're on the system. No, you have to be born over here. Maybe the children get benefits, but you're not getting nothing but harassed, especially if you're Black, if you're an immigrant.
Okay, that's an excellent point. And, you know, and so, again, as we're closing this need for unity, what I see is the patience that we as Black Americans need in coming together and, and actually coming together with some of our differences and getting to know one another. Because one of the things I experienced during this recent, when George Floyd was murdered and a lot of this racial awakening was going on, you know, police brutality was just at its height. Many of the immigrants that I came into contact with were explaining how they didn't know some of what we were telling them, but when they began to experience it, this was like an eye-opener. And so the need for us to unite and come together as Black and brown people, you know, I just think this is a lot opening up this ability, and I think it takes patience. It takes, you know, open-mindedness between all of us. You know, but the benefits, absolutely, the benefits are just wonderful. I mean, we have a brother and sister right now who are in Rwanda. They were some of,
yay,
Sister Ava's guests, and they've opened up a wonderful restaurant and establishment in the country of Rwanda. So black people being dual citizens, I saw that with you, Brother Joseph. I'm not sure if you have dual citizenship, but you're a traveler of the world, and you speak so many different languages, and this is that time we're living in. So you all, as attorneys, are really performing a great task, and I didn't want that
praise
not to be mentioned, because I've been practicing law for 30 years, and when I first started practicing law, this was a tinier practice. This was a tinier practice, you know. So to see the level of growth and just explosion when it comes to immigration law, this is something that is I think it's a blessing. I think, you know, it's something that we have to get behind with our people. So I know we're down to a short period of time, and Brother Joseph, I did promise you that the story that you had shared with me about wanting to just thank Sister Ava on the air, you were sharing some of where you all came from as attorneys, because Brother Joseph, as a new attorney, he's going to tell the story about how he came into contact with our sister, Sister Tiffany. I remember her as a law student. You know, she has been a wonderful friend and, you know, just a person, a sister in the nation that I've seen grow over these years. And so this is family. We're family. And so, Brother Joseph, I don't know if you wanted to share, and, you know, as we give our closing remarks.
Yes, ma'am. well, to answer your tacit question, yes, I am. I have dual citizenship. Let me rectify that. I have three citizenships. I am of Haitian. I am you know, so-called American, and I'm also a member of the Nation of Islam. So that's my third citizenship.
Yes, sir.
The other point regarding Sister Ava, I'm glad that you got that to my remembrance. As I was at Vermont Law School, as you know, Vermont is the second whitest state in the whole United States. And as a student there, my class composed of six black students in the whole class. And then in the whole school, there were about eight of us in the whole school. And the way that we were taught, you know, as knowing that the earth is the Lord's in the fullness thereof, wherever I am, I'm at home. So, and knowing who's the original man, the Asiatic black man, the maker, the owner, the cream of the planet earth, God of the universe. I couldn't just, you know, be there and think that I am inferior when I know based on the teaching that I am the original, from the original. So with that in mind, I felt compelled, even though there was no mosque and still there's no mosque in Vermont, coming from mosque number 7 in New York, shout out to our beloved brother Abdul Hafiz Muhammad, may his soul rest in peace and in power, for having been a mentor to me when I was at in law school at number 7. And so I was always taught that, you know, wherever we are, you know, though there may not be a physical mosque, you are in fact a mosque. You represent the mosque. You represent the nation wherever you go. So just a quick background. When I went to Vermont Law School, with that in mind, I started to, you know, create a movement on the campus, and I ended up, with the help of Allah, create an organization called Student Leadership Collective for Human Rights. Through a lot of mind how do you say, social engineering, I was able to convince the school to subscribe to 2 final calls a week. And then because, you know, they were promoting diversity and whatnot, I said diversity is not just based on color. Diversity is also based on perspectives and religious persuasion. So, you know, while they were promoting, you know, diversity, how they use that word, but wanting for their own purpose. So I use it for my own purpose. So I introduced the Nation of Islam, a newspaper on the campus at Vermont Law School. And then I was inspired by Allah to bring Sister Ava Muhammad on the campus to speak back in 2001 or 2. It was in January, and Sister Ava Muhammad came with her husband, traveling very far. You know, it was very difficult for her to get to Vermont, and part of it was we didn't have GPS back then, so I was giving her direction while she was driving. So long story short, she made it, and then she raised the roof at Vermont Law School, and then after, you know, people were very touched and moved by what she had to share. But, of course, I had oppositions, and I had people, you know, giving me anonymous phone calls. You know, they were calling me, you know, making, you know, threats and stuff. And then Saiba Muhammad said, brother, I don't know what you're doing, but you got to be careful being up there, you know, all by yourself and, you know, bringing that those type of issues onto your attention. So great. And based on what she shared with me, I ended up spending the rest of the semester at Howard Law School. And so that's where I finished my as an exchange student. So I graduated from Vermont Law School, but I went to Howard after Sister Ava Muhammad visited Vermont Law School.
Oh, that's beautiful. Isn't that a beautiful story? So, yes, sir. Well, you know what? We're down to the last minute, and I wanted to thank you all once again for coming on and talking about immigration law and black people. You all have presented kind of everything we need to know, and the callers have a way to contact you all as well. So at this point, I'm going to end this show. I think, you know, immigration law is so important. Not a lot of us know about it, but you all have definitely gave us a lot to look at, as well as why some of our people are here. So let's look at unity. This is where we are.
Thank you as well. And, of course, Dr. Ava Muhammad for always being that shining example. Before I got to law school, I was lucky Brother Ali, Houston, Texas, shared with me that you need to check out this sister right here. You want to be like her. You want to be like
That's
her.
Right.
He sure was right. So, alhamdulillah.
That's right.
Thank you all
That's
so
right.
much.
Yes,
and thank
ma'am.
You,
thank
Sister
you,
Pam,
beloved.
For being the sister who helped me and Brother Joseph, because he know you get sometimes you get the job before you know what you're doing. You call your brother in New Jersey. That's what I did.
That's right.
And
oh,
Brother Joseph is exceptionally helpful. Thank
yeah.
you, Brother Joseph.
Praise are due to Allah. And that on closing is a great point, because we as lawyers, both in the nation, black attorneys, we have to unite. We've got to pool our resources. And so that's what this show is about. And I would like to thank Sister Ava Muhammad as well, who is the Elevated Places Network, and remind everyone to listen to her show on Thursday. That's Ask Dr. Ava at 7 o'clock Central Standard Time. I would like to thank the Elevated Places team, Sister Donna Muhammad, Sister Rona Muhammad, Brother Terrence Muhammad, and Sister Samaya Muhammad. I would like to invite you all to listen to our archives on the Elevated Places at Blog Talk Radio. And once again, thank you all for listening. And please tune in next week for more informative discussions on A Time for Justice. Assalamu alaikum.
Thank you.
Thank you.